This is K-Town. I'm going to take you through some of the most creepy, chilling, and downright terrifying experiences you've ever heard. This is the X Podcast. Listener discretion is advised. I was a boy in a madman's world, muttered Elmer Wayne Henley, Dean Corll's accomplice, from the prison cafeteria of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. Yes, Henley was a boy of 15 in 1971, a boy charged with the murders of six teenage boys. If it wasn't for Corll, he wouldn't have killed at all, or so he said. It started with candy. In 1965, Corll was vice president of the family company, Corll Candy. In the mid-60s, the company was across the street from an elementary school in Houston, Texas. That was a very convenient thing for Corll, as he was a homosexual who delighted in sex with boys. Even teenagers could be lured in by candy, a fact that totally amazed him. Of course, they loved to play pool, and Corll saw to it that a snappy green pool table was placed in the back of that factory. Then Corll enticed the best-looking boys of the lot, offering them a ride home. But he didn't take them home. He invited them to his apartment with the promises of alcohol, marijuana, or a high from glue sniffing. Once they were high, he snatched their tender young bodies, cuffed them, and slapped tape across their mouth to the point of pain. He felt powerful as he hoisted them upright on a piece of plywood, tying their hands. He'd whip them or beat them with sticks or a belt, laughing when they tried to cry out, jerk away, or moaned. He would then unzip his pants and have his way with their innocent bodies over and over again. When he was satisfied, he would rest until the next victim. He especially liked boys with smooth brown hair that was nearly shoulder length, in keeping with the style of the time. He preferred clean looking and casually dressed. The most alienated among the boys hung out with Corll at the back of his candy company. He was friendly, accepting, and sociable. Corll was unlike their parents, so he became popular, and the boys felt like they belonged. Most of them had been deprived of affection for most of their lives. Corll liked it when they touched him. Enter David Owen Brooks. Corll wasn't very strong emotionally and knew he needed help to attract the boys that he preferred. At Helms Elementary School, he spotted 12-year-old David Brooks. Brooks really liked Corll because he didn't make fun of the fact that Brooks wore glasses. Corll accepted Brooks as he was. He did well, and he performed sexual favors. Brooks was one of those lost kids, the victim of the failed marriage of his mother. Like Corll, Brooks went bad, really bad. Brooks hated school too, where he was treated like an outcast. As soon as he was 16, he dropped out and lived with his mother for a little while. She didn't live that close to Corll. So in 1970, Brooks moved back with his father in Houston and closer to Corll. David Brooks' father let him hang out with Corll whenever he wanted, and that was ideal. Of course, he knew that Corll expected sexual favors, but that was okay because Corll gave him plenty of money and candy too. When Corll's mother sold the candy company, Corll had to get a job. Corll was a quick study and landed one at a Houston power and electric company. He was actually fairly good at it, only now he'd have to have his jollies at night. One day, young Brooks came over to Corll's apartment. In the bedroom were two 14-year-old boys tied up to a four-poster bed, one on each side of the plywood torture board, with their bottom half exposed. Caught by surprise, Corll swiveled around. "I'm just having some fun," Corll stated. Knowing that Brooks could be easily manipulated by the police into revealing his secret, Coral made a proposal to Brooks that would essentially make him an accomplice. Now that Coral was working during the day, Brooks would come in handy as he could lure new victims to his apartment. Brooks couldn't resist a hot car, so Coral bought him a fantastic green Chevy Corvette and promised him $200 for every boy that he could lure to his home. Why not, he thought. That is when the activity really picked up. But it is also when Coral admitted to David he had robbed and killed the two poster bed boys that Brooks had seen at his apartment by strangling them. In 1970, the first known victim was a good-looking 18-year-old college student by the name of Jeffrey Conan from the University of Texas at Austin. The university wasn't far from Coral's apartment on Yorktown Street in Houston. Brooks offered Jeffrey a ride home. On the way, Brooks offered him some weed to smoke at his friend's apartment. Was he interested? Sure. Brooks brought Jeffrey to Coral's place, introduced him to Coral, and gave him some marijuana. In fact, so much of it that Jeffrey got giddy. He dismissed Brooks and then, without warning, grabbed and bound the hapless teen to his pleasure board. Coral cut him on his back, whipped him, and beat him senseless. And then Coral had his way with him. Coral then wrapped his hands around Jeffrey's throat and squeezed. Jeffrey's eyes bulged out, and Coral tightened his grip until he heard the crunch of Jeffrey's hyoid bone. The boy was dead. Coral and Brooks then dragged the body to Coral's white Ford van and drove it to High Island Beach in Jefferson County. They stuffed a gag in Jeffrey's mouth, covered the body with lime, then wrapped it in plastic to kill the smell. Anxious to earn his keep, Brooks told Coral to expect a new visitor. He had a friend attending a religious rally nearby. In December of 1970, Coral was thrilled to be able to entertain two visitors, Danny Yates and James Glass. James was Brooks' friend, and he brought another along. Coral used his two-buddy system of having one boy manacled to one side of the plywood board and the other boy on the opposite side. That was a fun night for Coral. He whipped and beat the boys until they squirmed and twisted in screams and groans. And then he would have his way with each one, one at a time. It took longer that time for Coral to finish, but it was worth the wait. And then he strangled James and Danny, and then called Brooks to take the bodies to Lake Sam Rayburn, where he owned a log cabin with his mother. They rented a boat shed there and stashed the bodies under a foot of sandy soil. In 1971, Coral moved a lot to avoid capture, so he and Brooks moved to an apartment on Magnum Road in Houston Heights. Coral found it tough hanging on for a month to celebrate one of his orgies. They were so much fun. Coral suggested they go hunting for someone else. Like a wish come true, there they were. Jerry and Donald Wardrop were sauntering along the road. Want a ride and maybe a couple beers? Asked Coral from his white Econoline van. He was with Brooks, so this encounter wouldn't arouse any suspicion. The boys climbed in. It was time to have fun, but Coral's brand of fun wasn't what they had in mind at all. Brooks decided that Coral shouldn't have all the fun, and they partnered up and enjoyed a double session. Donald was tied to one side of their torture board, and Jerry was on the other. After viciously assaulting 13-year-old Jerry, Coral shot the boy with his .22 caliber pistol. Then he shot Donald. Coral then sent Brooks to the truck to drag out a giant tube of plastic sheeting he stole from work, generously covering the bodies with lime. Brooks and Coral took them to the boat shed for burial. Soon after, Coral was on the hunt for another victim. Rendell Lee Harvey, 15, employed at a gas station, was on his way to work when he mysteriously vanished. Coral decided to shoot him after having his brutal fun. Brooks and Coral buried him under the boat shed. Coral knew Gregory Molly Winkle, a former employee at Coral Candy Company. Gregory sometimes dated Rendell Lee Harvey's sister. In fact, they knew another future victim, David Hillingston, 13. David and Gregory were on their way to the local swimming pool, but their friends reported that they had been seen getting in Coral's white van on May 29, 1971. It was time for Coral to move again to elude any possible police searches. The missing boys that they had enticed into the truck was a hot topic on the newsstands, so they had to be careful. The next apartment was on San Felipe Avenue. No one knew them there. After the gritty, gruesome burial at the boat shed, it was time for Brooks to search for more lovers for Coral. Coral was becoming anxious and tired of jerking off to satisfy himself. So Brooks and Coral planned on telling their next victim that Coral was throwing a party. He then scouted out the rundown neighborhood of Houston Heights. Brooks came across a guy he knew from high school, Elmer Henley, hanging posters on telephone poles with a picture of David Hillingston on it. David had gone missing on his way to work at a local gas station, and Henley added that the boy was a friend of his. Brooks recognized the picture and smirked a bit when Henley said there was probably an innocent explanation for David's disappearance. Surely he'd turn up in a few days. Brooks already knew that Hillingston had been tied to the bedpost of Coral's apartment and killed there. As Brooks was helping Henley, he realized Henley would be perfect, as he was only 15, young, and good-looking enough for his mentor, Coral. So he invited him over to Coral's place for a good time. It was hot in Houston in May of 1971, and Henley was looking forward to a couple of beers and some AC on a sweltering day. At the end of the day, Brooks swung open the door and invited Henley in. Shortly afterwards, Coral arrived. When he saw Henley, Coral was a bit turned off because Henley wore glasses, and Coral didn't like that. However, after they chatted for a bit, Coral realized that Henley was smart, so he made a proposal, saying he was involved in a sex slave ring in Dallas. Coral asked Henley if he would like to recruit some boys for $200 apiece. Henley was taken aback and turned him down flat. Brooks had to pick up the pace in order to keep Coral supplied with young victims. In August of 1971, he checked out his friends up and down the streets of Houston. Finally, he came across 17-year-old Reuben Watson Haney as he was leaving a movie theater. Brooks convinced him to get in Coral's GTO, which was a pretty snappy car. As Reuben already knew Brooks, it was no problem. Brooks took Reuben to Coral's place, tied him up when the boy was sufficiently drunk, and Coral raped him incessantly. It had been a long time, so he dragged out that performance for 4 days. One day, he'd torture Reuben. The next, he would beat him within an inch of his life. Then he started all over again. When Coral tired of Reuben, he strangled him. It was a thrill to watch his throat bulge and hear him gag. Once in a while, Coral would let up just to hear him frantically gasp for breath. Finally, after Reuben died, they took him to the infamous boat shed and disposed of his body there. Elmer Henley, whom Coral tried to employ for his supposed sex slave ring, lived at home with his mother. When she went through a bitter divorce, Henley's mother was forced to work a part-time job just to support the two of them. When she was laid off from one of her jobs, they faced some financial straits. That's when Henley remembered Coral's offer for $200 per boy and took him up on it. At the beginning of 1972, Coral and Brooks moved to an apartment on Schuller Street. Coral was delighted when Henley showed interest in working for him, and Henley also showed Coral a neat trick he taught himself. For the trick, Henley took a pair of handcuffs, put his hands behind his back, and seemed to place the cuffs on himself. Then he appeared to undo the cuffs, and his hands would be free. Elmer explained to potential victims that they were trick cuffs. In reality, they were not. Brooks thoroughly enjoyed watching Henley perform the ruse on Willard Carmen Branch, whom Henley had left at Coral's apartment. After he and David got their rocks off on Willard, Coral shot him in the head and then buried his body in the old boat shed. Once Willard was buried, they realized that the ground under and behind the boat shed was full. It reeked with the stench of the devil himself. Why do rotting bodies stink so much? In March of 1972, Henley remembered his old friend, Frank Aguirre, from school. He was a nice-looking lad of 18. Surely, Henley and Brooks would have no trouble luring him into Coral's GTO. This time, Henley didn't pull the handcuff trick, as Frank had already seen it. So the lure of smoking some weed and having a few beers was enough. Once Henley and Brooks dropped Frank off, Henley had second thoughts. Perhaps Coral could just let him go. After all, he was a pal of Henley's. Coral delighted in cutting off Frank's penis. Then he strangled him to stop his howling. He, too, went to the boat shed. That's when Coral told Henley the whole sordid tale. There was no sex slave ring. Coral just wanted to rape and torture Frank. Then he pulled out the torture board stained with blood. Henley was horrified. Coral reminded him that he had participated in the abduction of the boy just prior to the murder of Frank. Even though he knew the whole sordid scenario, Henley didn't quit. Coral knew Henley's younger brother and liked their looks a lot. At his trial in 1974, Henley testified, "I couldn't leave anyway. If I did go, I knew Coral would go after one of my little brothers, who he always liked too much." Elmer Henley and David Brooks continued to recruit new flesh. Next came another friend of Brooks and Henley's, Mark Scott. They forced Mark to write a letter home saying he was working in Austin. That would keep the authorities from looking for him. After Mark was abused, Brooks and Coral, having run out of space at the trusty old boat shed, chopped up Mark's body, shoved it into a plastic bag, loaded it up with lime, and buried the eerie package at High Island Beach. There was a convenient area of flat land just beyond the beach, which was perfect. In 1972, Henley and Brooks lured Stephen Sickman and Roy Bunton into their truck with a promise of a party. Stephen had recently had a fight with his sister, so he wanted to get away for a while. Roy had just left his job at a shoe store and was just hitchhiking. Coral had his fun with those two boys on his double torture board, and Brooks helped out too. Coral beat up Stephen and strangled him with a nylon cord. He shot Bunton. They returned to the overfilled boat shed and buried both bodies there. The next victims in late spring of 1972 were Johnny Ray DeLome and Billy Blanche, abducted as they walked to the store. Both were assaulted after Johnny Ray was forced to write a letter to his parents stating he and Billy were working in Madisonville. Johnny Ray was shot in the head, strangled, and then Billy was strangled. They were buried at High Island Beach. Brooks wanted a larger piece of the action too, so he lured Wally J and Richard Hembry in his Corvette. Richard was abducted outside a grocery store in October of 1972. There was a problem with the two victims. Wally J tried to call his mother from Coral's place until the phone was disconnected. Henley was feeling like a big man that night and grabbed Coral's pistol. Richard was attached to the torture board Seeing that, Henley waved the gun around, laughing, but it went off and hit Richard in the jaw, killing him. To add insult to the brutal way he died, Coral strangled him anyway, and strangled Wally J as well. Time to move again. This time, Coral rented a comfortable apartment at Westcott Towers, Westcott Avenue in Houston. They continued their sinister activities. Coral had moved twice since the prior fall, to Wirt Avenue, and then he rented a house on Lamar Drive in Pasadena, Texas. At Wirt Avenue, Coral kidnapped a former friend of his, Joseph Allen Lyles. Brooks saw the abduction, although he didn't know any of the particulars about Joseph's murder. Coral was ill for a while between February and June of 1973, so there was a gap in the murders. Once Coral recovered, he demonstrated what Henley called a bloodlust. It had been a long time since Coral had sex, so there was an acceleration in the number of victims. William Ray Lawrence was a friend of Henley's and left his house, planning to go fishing with him. Coral staged a special performance for him to celebrate his own return to health. William was tortured for 3 days, urinating and defecating right there while tied to the torture board. Coral then finally strangled him with a cord, weighed him down, and threw him into Lake Sam Rayburn. There was new construction going on Lamar Drive in Pasadena, and that's where Coral enticed a tired construction worker to spend a fun evening. The man's name was Raymond Stanley Blackburn. He had come to the area from Louisiana to see his newborn and to pick up the construction job. While there, Raymond was strangled in Coral's residence and buried at Lake Sam Rayburn. When the number of missing person reports rose substantially, all the parents of teenage boys in Houston were on high alert. Parents of missing boys harassed the police, who tried to pacify them by insinuating they may have run away from home. And running away from home wasn't a crime. Nevertheless, many of the frantic parents insisted their boys weren't runaways. For example, when they were abducted, one was on his way to get a haircut. Another was at a job in a shoe store. Another was visiting a friend. And another was working the counter at a pizza joint. Those activities weren't really what one would engage in prior to running away. In July of 1973, Coral briefly changed his pattern, perhaps for the sake of variety. Henley met Homer Garcia, whom he was attending driving school with. He was shot in the head at point-blank range and bled to death in Coral's bathtub. Once he bled out, his body, too, was thrown into Lake Sam Rayburn. Next came Johnny Manning Sellers, a U.S. Marine. He was shot 4 times in the chest. Unlike Coral and Henley's other victims, his body was totally clothed. Coral and Henley stole his car. However, it was found in Louisiana a week later, totally burned out. At the end of July and early August of 1973, Michael Blanche, the brother of the victim, was slaughtered. He was the brother of Billy Blanche, who had been killed by Coral a year earlier. Like his brother, he was also strangled. Marty Ray Jones and his friend, Charles Carey Cobb, met Henley on 27th Street in Houston. It appears that they may have been taken by force. Also, Charles called his father in hysteria, claiming they had been kidnapped by drug dealers. Both were shot in the head and their bodies buried at the infamous boat shed. James, a.k.a. Stanton Dramula, a devout Seventh-day Adventist, was lured into Coral's trap. He disappeared after telling his parents he went to a party in South Houston. On October the 8th, 1973, Henley invited a guy by the name of Timothy Carley to one of Coral's so-called parties. In the meantime, Rhonda Williams, a friend of Henley's, called him, pleading for help. Her father was on a drunken rampage, and he beat her badly. She needed somewhere to crash until her father sobered up. Henley brought her along with Timothy to Coral's apartment on Lamar Drive. Coral flew into a rage when he saw the girl and grabbed his gun. He told Henley he ruined everything. After Henley meekly explained the situation, Coral seemed to calm down. He then kept shoving alcohol at the group until they passed out. When Henley became conscious, his heart jumped. He had been gagged, handcuffed, and his hands and feet were bound. Timothy and Rhonda were also bound, with their mouths taped shut. With a cruel snap, Coral ripped off Henley's gag. He held the gun to his head and told him he planned on having some fun with Henley after he finished up with Timothy. Henley tried to stay calm and spoke quietly to Coral. If Coral would release him, he would help mount Timothy on one side of the torture board and Rhonda on the other side, and Coral would be able to enjoy himself. Coral fell for the ploy and released Henley. Feigning obedience, Henley then manacled Timothy and Rhonda, watching Coral carefully. By this time, Coral was breathing rapidly, intensely aroused, anticipating a tremendous ending. He put down his gun and started tearing off his clothes. Henley then snatched up the gun, pointing it at Coral. Henley decided that Coral was not going to kill any more of his friends. Coral taunted him to kill him. He didn't think Henley had it in him to pull that trigger. Coral was wrong. Henley shot him in his forehead, but it didn't kill him. Coral ran away from Henley. Henley followed him out of the room and shot him repeatedly. His naked body dropped in the hallway. Dean Coral was finally dead. Henley called the police, telling the operator he had just killed a man. In a 1978 interview with Texas Monthly Magazine, Henley said, "There wasn't anything that could have made me more uptight than to have been drunk and stoned and hungover and having withdrawals. And then I just blew his life away. He would have been proud of the way I did it, if he wasn't proud before he died." August 1973, Henley turned himself into the police after shooting Dean Coral. In addition to his own confession, Henley testified against David Brooks. He assisted investigators in locating the bodies in the boat shed. He is incarcerated in the Michael W. Michael unit in Anderson County, Texas, and is serving a life sentence. In 1975, David Owen Brooks was put on trial. During the course of the trial, it was discovered that Coral had engaged in sexual relations with Brooks since he was 12. He indicated it was consensual. In his oral confession, he admitted that he lured at least six males to Coral's residence for sexual exploitation. Brooks was found guilty of the murder of William Ray Lawrence, committed in 1973. The authorities had the most convincing evidence, sufficient enough to convict him on murder. David Brooks was sentenced to 99 years and is incarcerated in the state penitentiary in Houston, Texas. He would be eligible for parole in the year 2028. That's it for this edition. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes. This is K-Town, and I'll see you next time on The X Podcast.